Chapter 10. Then amusing. But the pictures, oh, the pictures are noble still. First, there is Jerry arriving from the country in a green coat and leather gaiters, and being measured for a fashionable suit at Corinthian House by Corinthian Tom's tailor. Then away for the career of pleasure and fashion. The park. Delicious excitement. The theater, the saloon, the green room. Rapturous bliss, the opera itself, and then perhaps to Temple Bar, to knock down a Charlie there. There are Jerry and Tom, with their tights and little cocked hats, coming from the opera very much as gentlemen in waiting on royalty are habited now. There they are at Almack's itself, amidst a crowd of high-bred personages, with the Duke of Clarence himself looking at them dancing. Now, strange change, they are in Tom Cribb's parlor, where they don't seem to be a whit less at home than in fashion's gilded halls. And now they are at Newgate, seeing the irons knocked off the malefactor's legs previous to execution. What ardent ferocity in the countenance of the desperado in yellow breeches! What compunction in the face of the gentleman in black who, I suppose, has been forging, and who clasps his hands, and listens to the chaplain. Now we haste away to merrier scenes. To Tattersall's, ah gracious powers! What a funny fellow that actor was who performed Dickie Green in that scene at the play. Semicolon, and now we are at a private party, at which Corinthian Tom is waltzing, and very gracefully too, as you must confess, with Corinthian Kate, whilst Bob Logic, the Axonian, is playing on the piano. After, the text says, the Axonian had played several pieces of lively music, he requested as a favor that Kate and his friend Tom would perform a waltz. Kate, without any hesitation, immediately stood up. Tom offered his hand to his fascinating partner, and the dance took place. The plate conveys a correct representation of the gay scene at that precise moment. The anxiety of the Axonian to witness the attitudes of the elegant pair had nearly put a stop to their movements. On turning round from the pianoforte and presenting his comical mug, Kate could scarcely suppress a laugh. And no wonder. Just look at it now, as I have copied it to the best of my humble ability, and compare Master Logic's countenance and attitude with the splendid elegance of Tom. Asterisk, asterisk, now every London man is weary and blasé. There is an enjoyment of life in these young bucks of 1823 which contrasts strangely with our feelings of 1860. Here, for instance, is a specimen of their talk and walk. If, apostrophe says Logic, if enjoyment is your motto, you may make the most of an evening at Vauxhall, more than at any other place in the metropolis. It is all free and easy. Stay as long as you like, and depart when you think proper. Apostrophe, apostrophe, your description is so flattering, apostrophe, replied Jerry, that I do not care how soon the time arrives for us to start. Apostrophe, apostrophe, Logic proposed a bit of a stroll in order to get rid of an hour or two, which was immediately accepted by Tom and Jerry. A turn or two in Bond Street, a stroll through Piccadilly, a look in at Tattersall's, a ramble through Pall Mall, and a strut on the Corinthian path, fully occupied the time of our heroes until the hour for dinner arrived, when a few glasses of Tom's rich wine soon put them on the coup vive. Vauxhall was then the object in view, and the trio started, bent upon enjoying the pleasures which this place so amply affords. Asterisk, this refers to an illustrated edition of the work. How nobly those inverted commas, those italics, those capitals, bring out the writer's wit and relieve the eye. They are as good as jokes, though you mayn't quite perceive the point. Mark the varieties of lounge in which the young men indulge now: a stroll, then a look in, then a ramble, and presently a strut. When George, Prince of Wales, was 20, I have read in an old magazine, the Prince's lounge was a peculiar manner of walking which the young bucks imitated. At Windsor, George III had a cat's path, a sly early walk which the good old king took in the grey morning before his household was astir. What was the Corinthian path here recorded? Does any antiquary know? And what were the rich wines which our friends took, and which enabled them to enjoy Vauxhall? Vauxhall is gone, but the wines which could occasion such a delightful perversion of the intellect, as to enable it to enjoy ample pleasures there, what were they? So the game of life proceeds, until Jerry Hawthorne, the rustic, is fairly knocked up by all this excitement, and is forced to go home, and the last picture represents him getting into the coach at the White Horse Cellar, he being one of six inside, whilst his friends shake him by the hand, whilst the sailor mounts on the roof, whilst the Jews hang round with oranges, knives, and sealing wax, whilst the guard is closing the door. Where are they now, those sealing wax vendors? Where are the guards? Where are the jolly teams? Where are the coaches? And where the youth, that climbed inside, and out of them, that heard the merry horn which sounds no more, that saw the sun rise over Stonehenge, that rubbed away the bitter tears at night, after parting as the coach sped on the journey to school and London, that looked out with beating heart as the milestones flew by, for the welcome corner, where began home and holidays. It is night now, and here is home. Gathered under the quiet roof elders, and children lie alike at rest. In the midst of a great peace and calm, the stars look out from the heavens. The silence is peopled with the past, sorrowful remorses for sins and shortcomings, memories of passionate joys, and griefs rise out of their graves, both now alike calm and sad. Eyes, as I shut mine, look at me, that have long ceased to shine. The town and the fair landscape sleep under the starlight, wreathed in the autumn mists. Twinkling among the houses a light keeps watch here and there, in what may be a sick chamber or two. The clock tolls sweetly in the silent air. Here is night and rest. An awful sense of thanks makes the heart swell, and the head bow, as I pass to my room through the sleeping house, and feel as though a hushed blessing were upon it. On a joke I once heard from the late Thomas Hood. The good-natured reader who has perused some of these rambling papers has long since seen, if to see, has been worth his trouble, that the writer belongs to the old-fashioned classes of this world, loves to remember very much more than to prophesy, and though he can't help being carried onward, and downward, perhaps, on the hill of life, the swift milestones marking their 40s, 50s, how many tens or lusters shall we say, he sits under time, the white-wigged charioteer, with his back to the horses, and his face to the past, looking at the receding landscape and the hills fading into the gray distance. Ah me! Those gray, distant hills were green once, and here, and covered with smiling people. As we came up the hill there was difficulty, and here and there a hard pull to be sure, but strength, and spirits, and all sorts of cheery incident and companionship on the road. There were the tough struggles, by heaven's merciful will, overcome, the pauses, the faintings, the weakness, the lost way, perhaps, the bitter weather, the dreadful partings, the lonely night, the passionate grief. Towards these I turn my thoughts as I sit and think in my hobby coach under time, the silver-wigged charioteer. The young folks in the same carriage meanwhile are looking forwards. Nothing escapes their keen eyes, not a flower at the side of a cottage garden, nor a bunch of rosy-faced children at the gate. The landscape is all bright, the air brisk and jolly, the town yonder looks beautiful, and do you think they have learned to be difficult about the dishes at the inn? Now, suppose paterfamilias on his journey with his wife and children in the sociable, and he passes an ordinary brick house on the road with an ordinary little garden in the front, we will say, and quite an ordinary knocker to the door, and as many sashed windows as you please, quite common and square, and tiles, windows, chimney pots, quite like others. Or suppose, in driving over such and such a common, he sees an ordinary tree, and an ordinary donkey browsing under it. If you like wife and daughter look at these objects without the slightest particle of curiosity or interest. What is a brass knocker to them, but a lion's head, or what not? And a thorn tree with pool beside it, but a pool in which a thorn and a jackass are reflected? But you remember how once upon a time your heart used to beat, as you beat on that brass knocker, and whose eyes looked from the window above. You remember how by that thorn tree and pool, where the geese were performing a prodigious evening concert, there might be seen, at a certain hour, somebody in a certain cloak and bonnet, who happened to be coming from a village yonder, and whose image has flickered in that pool. In that pool, near the thorn? Yes, in that goose pool, never mind how long ago, when there were reflected the images of the geese and two geese more. Here, at least, an oldster may have the advantage of his young fellow travelers, and so Putney Heath or the New Road may be invested with a halo of brightness invisible to them, because it only beams out of his own soul. I have been reading the memorials of Hood by his children, asterisk and wonder whether the book will have the same interest for others, and for younger people, as for persons of my own age and calling. Books of travel to any country become interesting to us who have been there. Men revisit the old school, though hateful to them, with ever so much kindliness and sentimental affection. There was the tree under which the bully licked you. Here the ground where you had to fag out on holidays, and so forth. In a word, my dear sir, you are the most interesting subject to yourself, of any that can occupy your worship's thoughts. I have no doubt, a Crimean soldier, reading a history of that siege, and how Jones and the gallant 99th were ordered to charge or whatnot, thinks, ah, yes, we of the 100th were placed so and so, I perfectly remember. So with this memorial of poor Hood, it may have, no doubt, a greater interest for me than for others, for I was fighting, so to speak, in a different part of the field, and engaged, a young subaltern, in the battle of life, in which Hood fell, young still, and covered with glory. He bridge of size was his corona, his heights of Abraham sickly, weak, wounded, he fell in the full blaze and fame of that great victory. Asterisk memorials of Thomas Hood. Moxon, 1860. 2 vols. What manner of man was the genius who penned that famous song? What like was Wolfe, who climbed and conquered on those famous heights of Abraham? We all want to know details regarding men who have achieved famous feats, whether of war, or wit, or eloquence, or endurance, or knowledge. His one or two happy and heroic actions take a man's name and memory out of a crowd of names and memories. Henceforth he stands eminent. We scan him. We want to know all about him. We walk round and examine him, are curious, perhaps, and think are we not as strong and tall and capable as yonder champion? Were we not bred as well, and could we not endure the winter's cold as well as he? Or we look up with all our eyes of admiration, we'll find no fault in our hero. Declare his beauty and proportions perfect, his critics envious detractors, and so forth. Yesterday, before he performed his feat, he was nobody. Who cared about his birthplace, his parentage, or the color of his hair? Today, by some single achievement, or by a series of great actions to which his genius accustoms us, he is famous, and antiquarians are busy finding out under what schoolmaster's ferule he was educated, where his grandmother was vaccinated, and so forth. If half a dozen washing bills of goldsmiths were to be found tomorrow, would they not inspire a general interest, and be printed in 100 papers? I lighted upon Oliver, not very long since, in an old town and country magazine, at the Pantheon masquerade in an old English habit. Straightway my imagination ran out to meet him, to look at him, to follow him about. I forgot the names of scores of fine gentlemen of the past age, who were mentioned besides. We want to see this man who has amused and charmed us, who has been our friend, and given us hours of pleasant companionship and kindly thought. I protest when I came, in the midst of those names of people of fashion, and Beau, and Demureps, upon those names Er J.R.N.L.D.S., N.A. Domino, Mr. C.R.D.C.K., and Dr. G.L.D.S.M.T.H., in two old English dresses, I had, so to speak, my heart in my mouth. What, you hear, my dear Sir Joshua? Ah, what an honor and privilege it is to see you. This is Mr. Goldsmith. And very much, sir, the rough and the slash doublet become you. Oh, doctor, what a pleasure I had and have in reading the animated nature. How did you learn the secret of writing the decasyllable line, and whence that sweet wailing note of tenderness that accompanies your song? Was Bo Tips a real man, and will you do me the honor of allowing me to sit at your table at supper? Don't you think you know how he would have talked? Would you not have liked to hear him prattle over the champagne? Now, Hood has passed away, passed off the earth as much as Goldsmith or Horace. The times in which he lived, and in which very many of us lived and were young, are changing or changed. I saw Hood once as a young man, at a dinner which seems almost as ghostly now as that masquerade at the Pantheon, 1772, of which we were speaking anon. It was at a dinner of the Literary Fund, in that vast apartment which is hung round with the portraits of very large royal Freemasons, now unsubstantial ghosts. There at the end of the room was Hood. Some publishers, I think, were our companions. I quite remember his pale face. He was thin and deaf, and very silent. He scarcely opened his lips during the dinner, and he made one pun. Some gentlemen missed his snuff box, and Hood said, "The Freemasons' Tavern was kept, you must remember, by Mr. Cuff in those days, not by its present proprietors." Well, the box being lost, and asked for, and Cuff, remember that name, being the name of the landlord, Hood opened his silent jaws and said, "Asterisk, asterisk, 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 shall I tell you what he said?" It was not a very good pun, which the great punster then made. Choose your favorite pun out of Hymns and Oddities, and fancy that was the joke which he contributed to the hilarity of our little table. Where those asterisks are drawn on the page, you must know, a pause occurred, during which I was engaged with Hood's own, having been referred to the book by this life of the author which I have just been reading. I am not going to dissert on Hood's humor. I am not a fair judge. Have I not said elsewhere that there are one or two wonderfully old gentlemen still alive who used to give me tips when I was a boy? I can't be a fair critic about them. I always think of that sovereign, that rapture of raspberry tarts, which made my young days happy. Those old sovereign contributors may tell stories ever so old, and I shall laugh. They may commit murder, and I shall believe it was justifiable homicide. There is my friend Bax, who goes about abusing me, and of course our dear mutual friends tell me, "Abuse away, mon bon. You were so kind to me when I wanted kindness, that you may take the change out of that gold now, and say I am a cannibal and negro, if you will." Ha, Bax! Dost thou wince as thou readest this line? Does guilty conscience throbbing at thy breast tell thee of whom the fable is narrated? Puff out thy wrath, and, when it has ceased to blow, my backs shall be to me as the backs of old, the generous, the gentle, the friendly. No, on second thoughts, I am determined I will not repeat that joke which I heard Hood make. He says he wrote these jokes with such ease that he sent manuscripts to the publishers faster than they could acknowledge the receipt thereof. I won't say that they were all good jokes, or that to read a great book full of them is a work at present altogether jocular. Writing to a friend respecting some memoir of him which had been published, Hood says, "You will judge how well the author knows me when he says my mind is rather serious than comic." At the time when he wrote these words, he evidently undervalued his own serious power, and thought that in punning and broad grinning lay his chief strength. Is not there something touching in that simplicity and humility of faith? Oh, make laugh is my calling, says he. I must jump, I must grin, I must tumble, I must turn language head over heels, and leap through grammar. And he goes to his work humbly and courageously, and what he has to do that does he with all his might, through sickness, through sorrow, through exile, poverty, fever, depression, there he is, always ready to his work, and with a jewel of genius in his pocket. Why, when he laid down his puns and pranks, put them utterly off, and spoke out of his heart. All England and America listened with tears and wonder. Other men have delusions of conceit, and fancy themselves greater than they are, and that the world slights them. Have we not heard how Liston always thought he ought to play Hamlet? Here is a man with a power to touch the heart almost unequaled, and he passes days and years in writing, young men, he was a nice young man, and so forth. To say truth, I have been reading in a book of Ood's own until I am perfectly angry. O great man, you good man, you true genius and poet, I cry out, as I turn page after page. Oh, do, make no more of these jokes, but be yourself, and take your station. Gutenberg Edition. End of chapter.